You're listening to the We Lead Well podcast, where well-being matters. This episode is brought to you in partnership with Transform Education Coaching, headteacherchat.com and the Teach Well Alliance. Enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to another episode of the We Lead Well podcast. I'm Vicky Maguire. I work with schools, I coach teachers and senior leaders with the aim of improving their well-being, and whether that's through teaching and learning coaching, the one-to-one leadership coaching that I do through the Resilient Leaders Elements, or the group coaching program that I run for women leaders. I'm a passionate advocate for coaching and how it can significantly improve well-being. And today on the show, I have the pleasure of welcoming Simon Botton, also known as at South Gloss Head. So Simon is the head teacher of Black Horse Primary School in Bristol. He also does some executive head teacher work in some other schools, and he blogs as at South Gloss Head. And this is where I first came across him, and I really loved what he was saying in his blogs about leadership and about headship, and I just thought I really have to get him on the show because I knew that my listeners would really enjoy an interview with him. And as it turns out, Simon was a great interview. He had lots to say about how you can take on a headship, how to lead effectively in a school, how you can lead from a place of your values, how you can get buy-in from staff. So I'm absolutely certain you're going to enjoy this one. So here he is, Simon Botton. Simon Botton, welcome to the We Lead Well podcast. It's great to have you on the show. How are you today?
I'm very well, thank you. Nice to be here.
Yeah, good. Well rested because it's the summer holidays.
Oh, lovely. Yeah, you can't beat summer holidays, can you?
You really can't, but I always used to get the dread start kicking in when I got to about 2 weeks before I had to go back and started counting down the days. But are you looking forward to going back? Are you full of vim and vigour?
It's funny, you kind of, summer holiday follows a kind of a couple of weeks of just decompression to start with, just literally getting, you know, emptying work out of your head. Then it's that couple of weeks of just kind of being, and then it's that sort of couple of weeks of getting ready to go back. You know, it's that kind of, I always explain to staff, it's like going out on a sea voyage in the olden days. You know, you kind of have to sort of mentally prepare for going back to it because, you know, it's all or nothing our job, isn't it? You know, and I don't dislike that actually. I quite like the kind of the way the year sort of works. But yeah, you know, you have this summer holiday and, you know, God, I couldn't do without it. But yeah, the last couple of weeks you start to get, you know, your mind starts playing through what you're going to be doing. And by then I'm usually ready for it. So actually, yeah, I'm looking forward to next year being a bit more normal, hopefully. The last 2 years have just been anything but, as anyone working at school can tell you.
We'll come to that later because I do want to ask you about that. But first of all, I came across you on Twitter because Sue Plant, one of our previous guests, has retweeted quite a number of your blogs. And I've just been dipping into those and reading them. And the lot of things that you say, I really do identify with. And I think it'd be really good for the listeners to hear some of the things that you have to say, because I really like what you've got to say. But first of all, can you introduce yourself to the listeners and then just give us a little bit of a brief summary of what you do, what you've done, and who you are?
Yeah, so I'm known on Twitter as South Gloss Head. Because I'm a head teacher in South Gloucestershire, basically. And it was it was my old username on the Times Ed website years ago, actually. I'm a primary school head teacher of a 2-4 entry primary school in South Gloucestershire, which is actually the north of Bristol. So it's part of suburbs of North Bristol. I've been the head at Black Horse Primary School, where I am now, for just over 10 years, which is about 8 years longer than I thought I'd be there. I traditionally moved around quite regularly, my career kind of progressed up until there, but I kind of, you know, I've kind of fallen in love with Black Horse as a school and the community, and therefore stayed around a bit longer than I would have been usually. So it's my second headship. I was a headship at another school, Christchurch Hannam, for 3 years before that. That's my first headship. I was quite a young head, I think. Probably, I think I was 30 when I became a head. So I went straight to the first school I was head at was at imminent risk of special measures. And then when I took over Black Horse, I seconded into Black Horse to begin with, and then took over as standard head in 2011. And again, that was that just avoided special measures. Actually, we just got good by the time I was standard head. But it was still the least popular school in the county, had the third worst results. Skip forward 10 years, we are the second most popular school in the county. Our results are good. And we've got a really good reputation, particularly for things around, as well as high standards, but also we have lots of children with special needs in our school. We've got a resource base for children with language and communication needs. So we're very well known for things around positive behaviour approaches, positive approaches to special needs, and also things around school ethos and developing the whole child. So that's kind of my background, really.
I think that was the first blog of yours that I read. You've written a blog, haven't you, about how you've developed the ethos at Black Horse. And that really interests me because I really think in a lot of schools, there's not enough work done on values, morals, ethos, and that sense of everybody being involved in who, like figuring out who we are and exactly where we want to be. And it sounds like you've done a lot of that work. And I think that's really key to developing one of your first steps towards developing well-being in staff when they feel like they're really involved in what's going on in the school and they're valued as being part of that, being essential to where the school's going. So can you tell me about how you did that at your school?
Well, it's interesting. I think some of it was driven by need in terms of where the schools were. So both schools were, had developed a poor reputation in the local community. Mm. I would say. So they needed to rebrand themselves in order just to be able to survive, really, because if you've got a half empty school, you've got a half empty budget, then you can't do anything. One of the blogs I've written recently is, can you answer the question, why does your school exist? And it's interesting, when I was at Black Horse, one of the first governor's meetings I went to, there was a discussion between the governors about whether they changed the school name to try and change the kind of, expunge the poor reputation that had grown up around the school. I wasn't actually for that, and we kept the name. But I did ask the governors, and I asked, whenever I go in, I do a lot of work in the schools. And one of the first questions I ask is, why does your school exist? And it's incredible how many schools can't answer that question. So actually sitting down with the staff when I first took over at Black Horse, and at Christchurch actually, but certainly at Black Horse once I practiced being ahead for a bit and I was a bit more experienced, it was actually, right, what are we doing here? What is the point of this place? What was really interesting about school at Black Horse was, although the results were rock bottom, the children's behaviour was the best I'd ever seen anywhere in any school I'd been to.
Really?
Absolutely brilliant. And usually poor schools in turmoil usually have really poor behaviour as well.
Yeah.
But not at all. The children were absolutely lovely. So that kind of gave a starting point, because what you don't want to do as a head going into a school is to kind of, bulldoze through and destroy everything that's been a legacy of that school for many years. Because that's very disrespectful to the history and culture that existed before you. So it's actually, you have to try and build on what was good there before and work on that. So, it was one of the questions, why is the behaviour so good here? And a lot of that was down to the relationships between staff and children. You incorporated that into the ethos of the school going forward. So we really tried to sort of pin down what we wanted the school to be. What was the missing component when we were trying to articulate why did the school exist? And also, when schools are in a very poor position in terms of results and the outcomes, then you do need to project forward what you want the school, what would you like the school to exist for? Because at the time the school did have low expectations for pupils, and didn't see that there was always a slight excuse culture is too strong, but you know, the children's school had and still does have a lot of children with special needs, but that was almost given as a, well, we'll never get to, you know, good results because we've got so many children with special needs. I did not, I thought actually start to go down that road, you kind of hide into nothing.
That's, so we had to sort of change. Low expectations, isn't it? It's just that assumption that the children here are not capable of doing that.
No, and it was, yeah, and again, it was, you know, and that really winds me up when people say, oh, you know, children here, what can you expect? Something like that. You know, I expect them to be, you know, the best they can be and to be able to achieve really highly. I'd read a book, it's a very famous book now, Teach Like a Champion by Doug Lermontov. You know, I'd read that quite a long way, it just came out, so it wasn't quite as popular as it is now. And I'd also done a lot of research into the charter schools in New York, where again, really, really put kids that had absolutely nothing, came from grinding poverty in Harlem and Newark and areas around there, yet had the best educational outcomes in the state. And that was down to how the staff perceived their abilities. You know, what really triumphed me in those schools, they actually have on the back of their jumpers, and again, they have uniform, which is almost unheard of in America, they have the date that they will leave university, not the date they leave school, the date they will leave university. And that's, you know, from the day they start in year seven, or what the equivalent is in the States, you know, that is their expectation. We're getting you to university. And that starts a narrative then, doesn't it? Yeah. So, you know, when we came to revision the school at Black Horse and to look at why do we want the school to exist, we were quite overt in our thinking. So, you know, we the school was called Black Horse. You know, I remember the conversation in the staff room really well. We had a staff meeting. We were kind of throwing ideas around. You know, we needed to inject a sense of aspiration into ourselves and the children. And we were talking about, okay, what connotations do you have with horses? You know, and there's one kind of one of the teachers. He was an older member of staff. He was very funny, but he was, you know, his first comment was worth a punt, which we thought wasn't quite the tagline we should be going for. Then someone else came up. Well, you know, it was a year before the Olympics. What about something around champions? And that's where the whole kind of champion learners thing came from. You know, we build champion learners. That's what we do. And it kind of grew from there, really, that, you know, our school exists to have high aspirations for every child and to help them grow in every single way. So they believe, you know, it's that idea of, you know, a child starts in reception believing that they're going to be an astronaut or a you know, world famous X, Y, or Z. By the time they leave you at 11, their aspirations have lowered.
Yeah.
And we wanted our children, by the time they leave age 11, to still want to be astronauts, to still want to be the prime minister, to still want to be, you know, a world famous footballer, rugby player, athlete, you know, gymnast, whatever it is. We wanted them to have that unshakable belief that if I can put the effort in, then I will succeed. And that's kind of driven by everything we've done, really. It's interesting. Last year, we, by governors, and again, the governors have changed a couple of times since I've been there. And they said, well, you know, what's the vision about this building champion learners? And again, I thought it was really obvious, but actually, I suppose, you know, they were newer governors. They'd never known the school as it had been. They'd only know the school as it is now, which is reasonably successful. I actually sat down and tried, you know, it's when I was locked in here, actually, about to isolate because my son had COVID. But I sat down and we talked to staff about it. So we put it down to four key ingredients, which is, you know, we build champions through extensive opportunity, purposeful practice, expert tuition, and personal effort. And he says, right, those are the key ingredients that over the last 10 years have got the school to where it is, and this is why we exist. And again, you know, I said at the beginning, it's really, I'm surprised that many schools don't know why they exist, but it is quite, it's something that takes a lot of thinking about and a lot of revisiting in order for all the staff to really understand that. But it does help people all pull in the same direction.
Yeah, it's interesting that because a lot of questions in leadership interviews or head teacher interviews are about what would your vision for this school be, and it's a really difficult, I think that's a really difficult question to answer until you've asked the staff what they think and until you've really got the views of all of the stakeholders who are involved in your school. As a head, it's just not the thing to do, is it? I don't think it's ever going to work if you go in there and try and impose your vision on this school and say, right, this is what we're going to do. It has to be, like you're saying, that collegiate approach where everybody feels like they have their say and they can contribute to it, because then you get their buy-in when you're asking them to do things later along the line, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's it. Right back, we had lots of meetings with the parents, and even after children, the values and everything came from the children, in terms of, we have four values: respect, pride, bravery, and success. And, they were, the children voted for those and came up with them. And so everybody's got a, as you say, no one can disagree with something that they conceived, right down to the children. On the front of our jumpers, it says champion learners. If a child's, if they're not being that person, we say to them, when you put on that jumper in the morning, you've got to be the person to fill that jumper. It's a very easy shorthand with any members, with any conversation you have with anybody, is what we're doing building champion learners? And if the answer to that is no, well, why are we doing it? Does this fit our aspiration for what we've all agreed? And if the answer to that is no, well, again, something might need to shift a little bit. But again, it does. And what's been really interesting, and we may come on to COVID later, but particularly during COVID, that strength of understanding about the school's vision, I think, has had a huge impact on which schools have kind of weathered the storm relatively well and which have kind of really struggled in terms of, staff starting to kind of come apart a bit, really, because of the strain that they've been put under. I think if staff understands, what the school's about, then, they'll fill in the gaps themselves. They know what they're trying to do.
And that's really important when you're employing new staff as well, isn't it? Because it's really clear in everything that you do what your values are. When someone comes for an interview, they will very quickly understand what those values are and know if they fit in with that and whether that's something they can buy into as well.
Absolutely. When we're recruiting, we're very overt in our advertising about what we're about. This is what we're about. We'll make a little kind of little minute long video to go on social media and things. And actually, we get lots of applicants through that. Come from all over the country to apply to us. But they're applying because they want to be part of that, and that's what we want. We want somebody who wants to be part of what we want to achieve. And I think that's been a change for us. Because I think at one point, when the school was more vulnerable, we'd be looking for any member of staff who had a really good track record. Was outstanding or from an outstanding school, and sometimes the fit wasn't good, and that's no fault of theirs. It's just that they didn't want the same things that we wanted as a school. And I think we've learned over time, actually, what we need to get is people who want the same things as us. We can train them up on other things, but they need to have that same attitude to education that we've got.
It's very interesting, actually, that I can't think of a job interview that I've been for, and I was teaching for almost 23 years, in which I've been asked about what I think the values of the school are and what my values are and what I can bring to the school in terms of the school achieving its vision and buying into its values. I don't think I've ever had a question in an interview about that.
Well, it's really interesting. What we did, Joe, because obviously the last couple of years, well, last 18 months, we've not, a lot of the interviews, we weren't able to do some of it face to face. And something that I don't think I'd always do now, we asked the candidates in the last, both last year's teaching interviews and this year's, to make a 5-minute video and the task was, at Black Horse we value bravery, it's one of our values, make us a video about how you're brave. And that was fascinating. I found more out about those people than if I'd asked them all sorts of clever questions. What was really interesting was that one of the teachers we gave a job to, who's been absolutely amazing. Some people are just trying to show off. I've done this. I've climbed a mountain. I've very obvious feats of daring do. And she just started off with, "I'm not brave, but I do try hard." And she kind of, she was brave. She talked about personal experiences and overcoming personal adversity. But that gave her a window into her psyche, which for us said, this person's a perfect fit for us. And again, it's just been it's shown us so much about candidates asking things like that, more so than, tell us what you think about writing, because, they'll just tell you what they think you want to hear. But something like that really does give you a window on their personality. I think it's really important.
And you can teach teachers how to teach better, can't you? But you can't. Yeah. You can't essentially, really, you can't change someone's values. And if you can be sure that you've got the right candidate, then that's really important, isn't it, in terms of finding that fit with people?
And it seems to be, I'm interested, I like to find out about schools that are doing well, and I'll, you know, try and go and see them or speak to them. Calvin Atwell, have you come across Calvin Atwell? He's the head of Highlands School in London. He's written a book called The Thinking School, which
I've
is an excellent
book.
I really recommend
it. That's the one, John Tomsett, I was talking to you about Johnny Utley and John Tomsett, who've both been on the show, and John Tomsett refers to that book and how he's used it.
Yeah, it's a really interesting book. And again, it's interesting. He's taken over a couple of schools that are in special measures. And again, he's all about getting people with the right attitude and developing them. So when he's appointing NQTs, he doesn't ask them about, and this is a bit radical for me a bit, but he doesn't really ask them about teaching at all. He wants to know what they're like, have they got the stuff that he can mould? It's a fascinating book. I really recommend it. And again, he gets all his staff to do master's degrees, even in there. The first thing he did when he took over his school in special measures, he put everyone onto a master's program, which again is quite a different way of looking at things. But he's got some fantastic results, and his school's absolutely flying. Again, Chris Dyson, head of Parklands in Leeds, fabulous guy, great school. I went to the round there a couple of years ago, and amazing. But again, he just built a culture in the school where everyone knows exactly what they're about and has complete faith in one another, because they truly believe in what they're doing.
Yeah, it's amazing that you talk about this, because it's that sense of community, isn't it? And everybody pulling in the same direction. And I think when you go into a role as a head teacher, unless you can create that, and it's not something that you create overnight, obviously, but unless when you go into that school, you do that fundamental work on what are we working, what is this school about, what makes this school unique, what makes it special, what do we want to achieve with the children, what's special about us, unless you do that work, it's going to be more difficult to get to where you need to be.
And I think you've got to be careful, because I've also supported schools and I've been part of leading schools where the culture is based around the ease of existence for the staff, rather than the work that the supporting the children. And again, that can be, I was head of one of the schools and it was said to me, well, our children can't achieve as high as others because we really care for them. And actually, that was when I was just a brand new head, and I had a coach at the time who again made a really good point. He said, well, how can they say you care for children if you let them fail?
Yeah.
So again, it's not about, I think you've got to be careful not to be it all being about, us all having a lovely time and being friends.
Well, it's interesting. It's interesting that you should say that, because I made a little note about the high expectations that you've got for everyone, and you gave four things, and I can't recall exactly what they were. But one of the things that I've talked about probably on the show in the past and in some of the work that I do is how we are all just human beings, the children and the staff. And often we learn a lot as teachers about how humans work and how to get the best out of human beings from the work that we do with children in the classroom. And often we don't apply the same strategies with the staff that we're working with that we apply with the children often. Children love praise. They love feeling like there's purpose in what they're doing, and staff are the same. And in a lot of respects, that's because we're all human beings. And when you were saying that, I thought how important, how that applies also to high expectations. And you have to not only have high expectations for your children, but you've got to have high expectations of your staff. And that doesn't mean that you're going to, work them until they, to the point of exhaustion, but you expect the best out of them in terms of what they deliver to the children, and that they're committed to their own careers and their own development and being the best teacher that they can be. And that's really important as well, isn't it? I think those four things that you said about your children apply probably equally to the staff.
Absolutely. And it's interesting. I don't think I've always got this right as a head. It was interesting when, if I take my current school, Black Horse, it took us a few years to get things going in the right direction. Then it was, it improved really, we were really motoring along and getting really good results. We were, our popularity, was really high. And the problem then is, I think as a head, It's also a time when I started supporting other schools as an executive head. So perhaps my, you know, I was split between various roles. And I think if I'm honest, I probably relied on a command and control model. You know, we'd worked out the recipe. So then it became a delivery approach. You know, you come to our school, you deliver it like this. You know, and you know, because that's what we got so far. And I think the mistake I made there was to think that's how it was done. It's hard to explain. I think what happened was I then noticed that staff's their input, their agency in the school started to decline. They still did a great job. The teaching was still amazing, but their buy-in started to decline because it was a command and control model. The SLT said, right, you do it like this, and you do it like this, you know, because this is a model that we developed over many years. The model worked, got good outcomes from it. You know, I need to go away and do that. And I think I started to learn, you know, the light started going out of people's eyes a bit, I think. It's interesting, I'm reading Legacy, book about the All Blacks at the moment. It's a really good book. Yeah, they talk a lot about this. You know, it's how do you make sure staff feel really engaged in what they're doing?
Before we find out more about how you can keep your staff engaged, I'd like to tell you a little bit about our partner, Head Teacher Chat. Head Teacher Chat discusses lots of topics, from how to support pupils with learning, how to support parents, and the many issues that come with leading a school. The aim of Head Teacher Chat is to support head teachers and school leaders who are in a challenging and often lonely role. They do this by offering lots of information for schools to tap into. For example, they have lots of fantastic education companies on their database for leaders to discover, as well as leadership templates to download. They've written product reviews for leaders who are looking for products for their school. And this year, they've even launched the very first school leader planner, especially designed to help leaders to be productive and organised. If you'd like to hear more about Head Teacher Chat, you can find them on their website at www.headteacherchat.com. Head Teacher Chat, it's what head teachers are talking about. Now let's get back to the interview.
And they talk about, it's actually, again, it's a ridiculous sort of link, but they talk about an idea taken from the US military, actually. You didn't think, well, you know, how that applies to primary school, but they talk about the difference between command and control and mission control. And I think your command and control is, you know, the person at the centre makes all the decisions, passes them down, and people follow them. Mission control is the person at the centre sets the parameters, creates the frame, and then allows the people on the, you know, who can actually, who are actually dealing with the issue at the front, to work out what that means for them. And I think that's what COVID has changed for us, really. You know, COVID came along. We had no idea how to generate remote learning, no idea at all. So I literally sat the staff down and said, like, this is what we need to achieve. We've got to keep our children from getting behind. We've got to do, you know, these are the things we've got to be able to do. I have no idea how to do them. This is how we work as a school. We know that. And it's going to be down to your creativity to try and make that work. And I think I immediately, it's like someone flicked a switch. This kind of the creativity and innovation that came flowing out the staff as a result of that permission to interpret it as they felt fit was a real lesson to me, actually, about how to lead. So a lot of what we're looking to prepare for next year, and actually had been doing this year, was around how do we still, a friend of mine calls it freedom within the frame. You know, you can't just have anarchy. You can't just have people going off in every direction. That's just chaos. But how do you give them enough space to be able to feel that they've got that agency over their work? Because I think it's Daniel Pink or someone else was saying about, you know, yeah, it's one of the things that gives makes people motivated, is a belief that they have control over their destiny.
Yeah. It's a great book, by Daniel H. Pink. It's called...
Yeah, right. One of my governors, she's a leadership coach, and she talks about it a lot. And again, those things that make people feel that they are, you know, they makes them feel happy in their work.
Yeah, I've just completely lost because my phone keeps beeping and it's just totally distracted me, and I don't know how to switch the volume off and listen to you at the same time. But what I think is that sort of split dichotomy between wanting to offer your staff freedom to be the masters of their own classroom and what they're doing. But when you go into a school that needs to improve very quickly and having to create that, like you're saying, that command and control that you've got to do in a school that's heading for special measures to change it in the other direction, and having that, I suppose there's some dissonance, because if you're that sort of ethical leader who believes in values and believes in all that, that sort of respect and autonomy and mastery of your subject and those things, that can sometimes, it doesn't sit well, does it, with having to go into a school and make some very quick changes in order to start improving things?
I think it can, as I say, I think both can coexist. It depends where the school is. You know, if you've got staff who are, through no fault of their own, who are undertrained, are not achieving good results, the school is in a very crisis point. As a leader, it is fine to go in and say, right, we're doing it like this. In the short term, that's okay. Particularly if it's something that's about how you teach maths. That's not robbing the school of its vision and its culture. That's a technical, here's how we do this. If you know how to teach English, if you know how to teach reading to six-year-olds, and that's why things like synthetic phonics or anything, these programs are optional because they work.
Yeah.
So it's okay for that. I think what you don't do at the same time is to try and bulldoze through, as I say, a vision which is run so counter to what the school has historically existed for, that it then disenfranchises everybody. And this is where it comes to culture again. Only when the culture of the staff is strong enough can you then actually start to make that frame bigger, so that they've got more freedom. Because I think if you do that prematurely, I've seen lots of schools do this as well. They've had a crisis period, the heads come in, they've driven through changes, that things have improved, then they've kind of gone back to, right, okay, I'm going to step back a bit now, I'm going to let you be. And what's happened is actually everyone's gone off in 100 different directions. Nothing's followed through. And the school then finds itself quickly starting to kind of go downhill again, because the culture's not yet strong enough. I always say it needs to be baked into the brickwork for it to not to be fragile. To start with, a culture is really fragile. It takes years for culture to become, to solidify. And if you start to remove the scaffolding around people too early, then it will just disintegrate again, because they have there's not that, everybody's not yet in that same space and has the same understanding of why the school's there, to be able to maintain more freedom.
It's the command and control thing as well. I think that brings me round to the latest blog of yours that I've read about laziness being a strategy. Yeah. And I think in that, you refer to, it's hard, isn't it? Because we're trying to create more autonomous communities in our schools. And Ofsted are saying, you don't have to teach in any particular way. We don't expect to see any specific type of teaching. But yet we are still part of a command and control system that tends to make people or leaders in schools think that they should do that in their schools because that's what works. And then that leads to sort of overworking, and it's not a good place to be, where you're working 100 hours a week and doing all that stuff. Tell me a bit about that and how you...
Well, that particularly about strategies being parachuted into new schools, into other schools. I've seen that, because that's I do a lot of work in schools, as I said, that either are or have been in very vulnerable situations, either as a temporary executive head or whatever else, or supporting the current head. And invariably what I see a lot of is ideas just snatched from somewhere else. And I use the word snatched very deliberately, and hastily thrown into something. There's no thinking behind it. They don't understand the philosophy of it, and then it doesn't work. And you get hundreds of false starts then. And that's because they're not deliberately taking their time to improve something. Now, it's interesting, what we've done at my school this year and across some of the schools I work with is, you know, improving teaching is what has the biggest impact. We've been working with the Education Endowment Foundation, and they basically said that's what makes the biggest difference. So if our children are behind, the catch-up premium, the biggest thing you can do is improve teaching in the classroom. So but rather than say, okay, we as an SLT have chosen these things, right, get on and do them, we set the staff into the research groups. So there's a group looking at modelling in writing, got a different group looking at questioning in special needs children, you know, lots of different things going on around Rose and Shine's principles, actually, because they kind of, you know, recognise those as being, you know, a bedrock of good teaching. So actually what came from that is, you know, at some point we're going to need to make a teaching and learning approach that we all follow. But the research into it's coming from the staff rather than from just the leaders. And actually they're the people who are doing this on the ground. So they spent a year kind of developing their understanding of one of the key areas to kind of then feed that into this kind of whole school approach. And I believe that actually then, it gives that agency again, but it helps people feel that they are constructing something that they really understand. You know, they spent a year. So some of our staff have spent a year just developing the questioning techniques they use in comprehension lessons. That's all they've done in terms of their professional development. But they are absolute experts at it. They've read everything there is to read about it. They really understand it. And it's that authentic understanding of something, isn't it, that only comes through really focusing on something. It's interesting. I was at a meeting with David Carter, the ex-schools commissioner, and he said something really interesting, which I think is lost in translation a lot. He said, basically, any school that's got more than three things on the school development plan has got too many things on the school development plan. And that's really interesting. Three things, you know. You look at most school development plans, probably including mine, you'll have 5, 6, 7, 8, you know, and then everyone has a little thing that they want to add on. Before you know it, you've got just this mush of stuff. And actually what we see, I think we're learning, is we need to do less better. And that's what the best schools do. They do less better. And that's how people become really confident and expert in what they're doing, rather than just having things thrown at them by people who are feeling increasingly under the cosh themselves as leaders that aren't really well understood.
I just muted them because, as I told you before, there's a Hoover going on in the background. So if you can hear the Hoover, okay. I do apologise for it. I think it's interesting that you say that, because what you talk about as well, we talked about the pandemic, and I want to talk about that, because if you can focus on fewer things, I think you're probably less likely to be exhausted, because you're not trying to do too many things. And then you just scratch the surface of all those things, don't you? And there's nothing that you're sustaining that you're giving that time and effort to. But I think one of the things that's happened is that the pandemic has made staff exhausted. And there's a sense that, oh, once we get through the pandemic and we get back to normal, you know, everything's going to be okay. And I think it's been easy to blame the pandemic for teachers and leaders' exhaustion. But I think a lot of teachers and leaders were exhausted before that. And one of the things that you talk about in the strategic laziness, how rested leaders make better leaders, is working fewer hours means you can do your job more effectively. So I think I've asked two questions there, but if you can make your way through it. And
so, yeah, it's interesting, because that blog I almost just wrote is a kind of off the cuff sort of, I guess I was worried when I looked at, you know, I like to go on Twitter, I think edgy Twitter is really interesting. I think I've learned a lot from it. But I was really worried about this kind of culture building up of staff spending all of their summer in some kind of arms race of how pretty they can either make their classroom look, or how many education books they read, or how they were squeezing more and more into the holidays. And I thought, God, if I was either a new teacher or a new leader, I'd be feeling really crap unless I was doing that myself, because I would really be worried about whether I was doing my job. And it's really interesting writing that blog. I basically said, look, you know, it's okay during the holidays not to do any work. It's absolutely fine. You know, you need to have that decompression time and time to think and just be. And again, had a huge, you know, a response from it. You know, people from literally all over the world contacted me about it. And so it really softly chimed with people. It's something that was felt quite deeply by people, that they felt that they were working themselves to the point where they couldn't think straight. I think that'd be the best way to put it. because they were so busy trying to be, trying to keep all the plates in the air, sometimes doing pointless tasks, that they weren't actually thinking strategically about their work, whether that be at a classroom level or as a whole school leader, because they didn't have the headspace to do it. And I think the pandemic, I wrote in one of my other blogs about the pandemic and the effect it had on our school. And I describe it as almost like someone pressing the emergency stop button. So everything that we'd been doing, the more and more things that we'd lined up in our school to do, all stopped. And it kind of gave us permission then to think, okay, rather than just flicking a switch and put everything back on again, what do we actually want to be doing? And what's just happened over time because it's just become a thing that we do that actually doesn't improve things. It's not highly valued by the staff or the children or the community. What's just there because it's there. And something's, like marking was a classic case in point, wasn't it? I still do believe in marking. I know some schools do kind of whole class marking. We know we do still do individual marking, but it became this kind of, again, arms race of how much marking you can do, that triple depth marking, which was just crucifying teachers. Planning is another thing, where teachers weren't planning for the class. They're planning for the person who was going to be reading their planning, which would be one of the teachers, head teacher or somebody or Ofsted. So again, it's trying to strip things back to actually give people that space to breathe. I think what we discovered this year, by giving people one thing to focus on, then the other things didn't stop. I did a learning walk with my deputy, in June time. And again, there's absolute hive of activity at the school. There was all these little kind of intervention groups happening. I said, what's going on there? We didn't ask them to do that. And I asked a member of staff, I said, how come you've started this little reading group? Because I'm really interested about that. It seems to be working really well. And it's no one's asked you to do it. And I said, that seems to change to me. And she said, I do it because I feel I've got headspace to be able to do it. So I feel I've got the headspace to be able to focus on the things that I think are going to make the difference rather than trying to do a mental checklist of what somebody else is expecting me to be doing and feeling that I'm not letting someone down in some way. So I think it's trying to get an essence of that, particularly when we go back in September. How do we not just, as I say, restart all the engines and go back to how we were, where, as you say, I think sometimes we were working, as I say in my blog, we worked the longest hours in this country, in all sectors, and had the lowest productivity. And it's because we're busy a lot of the time, but we're not effective, we're not efficient.
I worked with a head teacher who was probably doing 70-hour weeks and like working so hard. Then it felt like there was an expectation on the rest of the senior leadership team to work that hard. And if you weren't doing 70 hours a week, what were you doing? You're obviously pretty lazy then. But my metaphor for that was like, it was like that person was on an exercise bike in the gym going absolutely flat out. But the exercise bike is just staying where it is. It's not going anywhere. You're putting all that work in and you're not moving it anywhere. And sometimes I think lots of people see work as, well, if I do 70 hours work a week, then I must be, I must be doing the right thing and that must be. But it's like you're saying, if you've not got the space to think strategically about where you're going, then in a way, a lot of it is pointless work.
It's interesting. I think there's a danger that, if you're working 70 hours a week and you've got staff that are all doing the same, your school will probably do all right for a bit. And I was speaking to a colleague who's moved from another part of the country, his teacher just joined us, and the school down the road, which was very high profile teaching school, outstanding, best results in the county, yet the staff, it was seen as a no-no to leave the school before 7 p.m. They're expected to be there at 7 a.m. and they're expected to leave at 7 p.m. Now that is a very toxic culture. Yet to everybody looking in, amazing. Austin couldn't praise it high enough because it was, getting amazing results. And I think that's the danger. And I think it's unintended consequences. And I'm not somebody who thinks Ofsted's a bad thing. I think Ofsted can be a good thing. I was a trained inspector for a while myself. But I think one of the inspectors I heard talk about it, one of the national team said about when Ofsted give a nudge, it becomes a shove. Everyone misinterprets that as something and everyone rushes off to do it. And unfortunately, if Ofsted are rewarding schools by giving them outstanding and accolades, you know, they don't actually look at how that happens. You know, if you're getting amazing results, great. You know, if you're, it doesn't matter that you're kind of killing the staff.
Yeah.
I think that's changing slightly. I think there's more emphasis on staff well-being now. You know, I think there was a school, I'm not going to mention it, but it was in the paper the other day, wasn't it? About, you know, again, one of the highest profile
and highest paid
CEOs.
Yes.
Whose staff seem to be saying there's a toxic culture here. And I think, you know, I'm not suggesting all.
And Ofsted had said, hadn't they? Staff had had ample opportunities to come and speak to us. But if you're working in a school where there's a toxic culture, it's a bit naive of Ofsted to think that those people are going to come and, I suppose, whistle blow during the school day when Ofsted are actually there. That is rather naive, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, it's if you're a, you know, as a head teacher, I always say to my students, we make the weather. You know, if we are, you know, and I've, you know, I went through a part of my career where I was working 70-hour weeks, and you can do that for a little bit, you know, if it's a short-term thing. And sometimes you have to. For short-term, you just have to do it.
And but I think probably
that becomes the norm.
When you first start in a role, whenever I've started in a role as a senior leader, I've worked long hours to get myself started in it, to get things in place and to do the work that I need to do. But that's never been sustainable for me to do 60, 70 hours a week long term.
And I think the better way of looking at it is, I think, you know, the way I look at it is this staff member achieving the outcomes I need them to achieve? So, you know, I had some staff members who, for whatever reason, personal circumstances, would be out the door at 4 o'clock, yet their books are always exemplary, their outcomes are always excellent. I don't care if they're out the door at 4 o'clock, if their outcomes are excellent. You know, that's none of my business. You know, how they choose to organise their time is theirs. And I think it's much better to look at outcomes. You know, are we achieving what we need to achieve? And then if we are, great, that's how we do it, not trying to, you know, sort of, because again, I think also schools, it becomes a culture, who can be the last out every day?
It's almost, or the first in.
You know, it's like some people get in there at 7 o'clock. Now, some people like to get there at 7 o'clock because they leave early. Fine, that's entirely up to you. But, you know, if it becomes the thing that, I think particularly younger staff, it does become a thing, you know, they can, you know, they feel they need to do that, then that becomes a problem.
So I'm mindful of the time. And you talked about ethical leadership, and I think a lot of the things that we've talked about today are ethical, you know, they're elements of ethical leadership. And I think trust is what you're moving on to now, isn't it? And it sounds like it takes it, you know, you don't just get immediate trust, do you? It takes a while to build a sense of trust, and how that trust works both ways. Your staff trust you as leaders and you trust your staff. So how have you developed that? How have you managed to do that over those years?
Again, I think it's about being authentic is really important. And again, that sounds a bit highfalutin, but I think when I first became a head, I tried to be like the heads that I'd admired. I tried to kind of ape them.
Yeah.
You know, I literally, my first headship, the staff said, you know, I never showed any emotion to anything, literally nothing, good, bad or indifferent. I was completely sort of straight, you know, which they said in one case was brilliant because it meant I could, you know, they didn't worry about my emotional sort of, there was no kind of up and down, it was always the same, but it's also a bit unnerving because they never really thought you were thinking. I think it's about, you know, you have to model to people how you expect them to behave, you know. So, you know, behaviour is really important in any organisation, isn't it? And and establishing a agreed sets of behaviours that we will all subscribe to. And, you know, that Brené Brown's book, I'm also reading that at the moment, Dare to Lead, and, you know, that clear is kind, unclear is unkind.
Yeah.
It's about being clear, you know, are we being clear with one another? So that, you know, I think that's how you develop it as a leader. It's not an act. It's not something you're putting on while people are watching. It was that quote, isn't there? Character is what you do when no one's looking. You know, and it's that, isn't it? It's, you know, you want people to do the thing because they truly believe it, not because someone's watching them. And I've seen some fantastic heads who actually I don't think are very authentic, and they're doing it because it serves their purpose, not the school's purpose. It serves their career path, their ego. And, you know, again, that works for a short amount of time, but doesn't work for a long time because people see through you. You know, people trust you because your actions and your words match. If they don't match, then then you've got a problem, because they'll either think this person's just full of hot air, or they'll think, you know, this person actually, you know, there's something not quite right with their kind of their morals here.
Yeah, I think Brené Brown's done quite a lot for leadership, and you know, in a vulnerable, you know, being vulnerable as a leader as well, and showing the people you work with that you, like you said, you went into that role like sort of with neutrality, or you know, I'm in control, I can do this, rather than sometimes accepting, you know, as a leader, there are things that you don't know and you can't do, and being open about that with the people who you work with as well, so that they see that in you.
Yeah, and I think it's again, it's a balancing act. And then Brené Brown talks about this. You know, I supported, you know, I've been in situations where I've supported leaders where they are a little bit too open about how they're feeling, you know, and will sob openly in the staff room about their despair about the state of the school. That's not helping. No. You know, that's just gonna rattle a lot of the staff. You know, you need to, some things you need to hold yourself, because that's, you know, but I think it's showing within reason, actually, you know, this is what I know, this is what I don't yet know. And we can all work together on figuring out. I think that's how to do it, isn't it? It's not, as you say, that vulnerability isn't about, you know, passing your worries onto others. It's about it's understanding the complexity of the role. I think sometimes staff do need, particularly in primary, I think that sometimes there's leaders don't always feel that they have the authority just to lead. I think sometimes there are situations where when staff are scared, COVID was, there's lots of, you know, I'm sure all the heads, you know, listen to this will identify with that, is sometimes you just have to stand up and lead and show this is how we're going to do it. And actually sometimes it's a steadying the line thing, you know, you have to show people a confidence that perhaps, you know, wasn't fully there yourself. You know, you didn't know. I had to tell staff that everyone was going to be okay. I didn't know everyone was going to be okay, you know, physically okay, I mean, in terms of no one dying of COVID. You know, there were times when that was the kind of conversation that had to be had. But, you know, so sometimes the lead, you have to show that confidence to do that. But yeah, other times it's about, you know, admitting that you don't have all the answers.
Yeah. So, finish us off with, what are your hopes for returning in September?
I think some kind of, I want to see how the world's turned because of this. Again, I really hope that the educational establishment doesn't just try and flick a switch and get everything back to where it was straight away. You know, I think we've learned a lot during the pandemic, which has been good. About how we lead, about how schools are inspected, about all sorts of different things. And I think that needs to be understood rather than just a headlong dash straight into things. So I'm hoping that the messages coming from on high will be calibrated by the research that's coming as to the impact of the closures on children, particularly vulnerable children, not just based on ideology, because that's my fear. I always worry, and I see it a lot on Twitter, when people talk with a lot of conviction about something they don't actually know to be true. You know, this is more complicated than people like to suggest.
Yeah, and I hope that we can learn from what's happened during COVID, that we don't just go back to the way we've always done things. That we can do.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the relationships we have with parents now are just on a different plane to what we had before. I think our staff have become a lot less judgmental. They speak to the parents as human beings rather than, you know, as somebody, you know, as lay people who don't really understand it, don't really get it, you know, and You know, there was always that barrier, wasn't there, before, where, you know, we're trying to be all professional and, you know, people in charge.
And probably the other way around as well. I think
absolutely.
Probably parents have more of an understanding of what a difficult job it is.
Yeah. So I think if I was wanting one thing to change forever, it would be that.
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us. I could, as per usual, I could just talk to people all day about all this stuff, but I know you've probably got other things to go and do. So thank you so much for joining us. Can you just remind us again of how people can find your blogs and find out more about
Yeah, probably Twitter's the easiest thing. I'm South Gloss Head on Twitter. Likewise, if you just type in South Gloss, just South, and then GLOS Head, just type in South Gloss Head and then blogs into Google, they come up at the top there as well.
Great. I hope things go really well for you in September. And maybe you'll come back on the show again at some point, because we really didn't get to talk enough about ethical leadership. So you probably have to join us
more
at
than
some,
happy
point,
to. Yeah,
some point in the future. Thanks so much, Simon. That was brilliant. Take care.
All right. Thanks a lot. Thanks.
What a great guy. I really, really enjoyed that interview with Simon. He's got so much to say about how to lead effectively. And I think the key thing that I really agreed with Simon on in that interview was asking the question, why does your school exist? This is such a key question to ask. And if you are taking on the role of a head teacher, if you are going into a school as a new head teacher, that has to be the first question that you ask your staff. Why does this school exist? And then maybe some other key questions that come out of that, such as, what's unique about the school? What does this school offer? How does it fit into the community? What are the children like who attend this school? What do you want those children to be like? What does teaching and learning look like in this school? What sort of community is this school? But they are such important questions to ask, to find out before you actually start on any of the work of being a head teacher. And Simon said he sat down with the staff and explored this question, why does your school exist? And that is so important, to really try to get to understand the values that underpin the school that you are working in or that you are going to work in. And it's also really important to engaging the staff in the work that you want to do with them. It's about understanding them and about them seeing that you are interested in them as well and what they bring to the school. Another thing that he talked about was the high expectations of all, and having high expectations for pupils is just so important. But likewise, having high expectations of staff is important too. Expecting the best from staff, because when staff are performing at their best, they feel better. They feel like they are achieving something. And he talked about the agency of staff and how the buy-in waned because they'd adopted a command and control model, which Simon felt was necessary at the start of his journey with the school. But he was talking about freedom within the frame. And I think that is really important. And we've talked before on the show about the importance of systems and processes that all staff are familiar with. And this includes policies as well. And it's about having freedom within the framework of those systems and processes and policies, because they provide the structure for staff. They provide the safety and the security and the certainty that staff need to perform at their best. But then allowing freedom within those frameworks is so important, allowing staff the creativity to do things the way that they feel they can do things best within that framework. And the importance that he placed on teaching, and obviously the EEF research that suggests that improving teaching has the biggest impact on pupil outcomes. If you improve the teaching, you will improve pupil outcomes. But staff also have to be involved in that too. They have to be able to focus on the areas that they want to develop in. So he talks about some research projects that staff were doing, a little bit similar to what we learned about from Johnny Utley and John Tomsett in their schools. So all those things come together to create the ethos that you want to create in your school. And that is really, really important. And I want to say thank you to Simon for his honesty and for sharing his journey in headship and for giving an insight into what it's like to be a leader in a primary school. It was really, really great to talk to him, and I actually learned quite a lot from that interview. So that's all we've got time for today. I would still like to say I have got a couple of places left on my Women Lead Well group coaching programme. It's had really brilliant feedback. It's really empowering, and it really will provide you with the clarity that you need to know where you are going and what you need to do to get there. So if you are interested in taking up one of those last places that's available on the programme, you can get in touch with me via my Twitter page, We Lead Well, and my LinkedIn page, so it's Vicky Maguire on my LinkedIn page, or you can join the We Lead Well group on Facebook, and you can message me via that. So if you are interested, please get in touch, and I will be happy to have a chat with you to talk about what that programme can bring for you. Thank you so much for listening to the show. Take care of yourself, take care of your staff, and lead well. This episode of the We Lead Well podcast was brought to you in partnership with Transform Education Coaching, headteacherchat.com, and the Teach Well Alliance.